We're often urged not to carry negative emotions around with us. There are even many songs on the subject. Think Let It Go from Frozen. But there is some potential value in remembering the people who have treated you in ways that you did not like. There are probably a few songs about that, but we'll focus instead on a book in this hour. Sophie Hanna is the author of a self-help book called How to Hold a Grudge, From Resentment to Contentment, The Power of Grudges to Transform Your Life. If the name sounds familiar, Sophie Hanna is a prolific writer of crime fiction with works published in 49 different languages. Those include three new works on Agatha Christie's Hercule Poirot character. Sophie also writes poetry. She lives in Cambridge, England, and joins us from the UK. Thanks for joining us today, Sophie.
Thanks for having me on.
So this work is not crime thriller, not poetry. How did you end up here?
It's not crime or poetry at all. It's self-help. And how I ended up there was that for years, for as long as I can remember, I've been addicted to self-help books. That's probably the genre that I read most of after crime fiction. And I never imagined I would write a self-help book. But when I had the idea for How to Hold a Grudge, I just couldn't resist, partly because I wanted to say something that none of the other self-help books seemed to be saying, but also because I've just always been so interested in the subject of grudges, and I'd always kind of assumed that because grudges are just everywhere, that there would be plenty of literature about them. And so when I went to search for books on the subject of grudges so that I could read up on them and discover why we hold them and whether they're good or bad and what kind of personality types are more and less likely to hold them, when I did that search, I found that not one single book on the specific subject of grudges had ever been written and published. And I just couldn't believe it. I thought, you know, most of our common human experiences like love, hate, anger, forgiveness, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of books about all those topics, and not one single book on the subject of grudges when we've all had them or, you know, tried to resist having them. And that just seemed bizarre to me. And I thought, I have to write a book about grudges. So I did.
So the way you tell the story, though, Sophie, your original desire was really to write a book about how not to be a doormat or how to be a doormat or something like that?
Yeah, so I'd always thought to myself, you know, I love the self-help genre. I probably would never write anything in that genre, but I always used to joke about how maybe one day I'd write a self-help book, never really thinking that I would. And then one day I said to my sister, somebody had treated me badly and I was moaning about it to my sister. And I said to her, you know, I'm just going to write a book called How to Be a Doormat, that on the face of it will be a self-help book suggesting that everyone should be a doormat. But actually, it will be using reverse psychology to impress upon people that they shouldn't be doormats. And my sister said to me, but you're not a doormat. You're the last person who should be writing a book called How to Be a Doormat because you're just not one. I said, what do you mean? Of course I am. She said, no, what you are is someone who holds grudges. So I said, well, isn't everybody? Like, doesn't everyone hold grudges? She said, no, not in the sort of analytical, deliberate way you do and not with so much enjoyment. And I realized as she said that, that was quite true and that actually, as I'd read all those self-help books over the years, part of the problem that I had with them was that a lot of what they were suggesting would require me to give up my grudges, because so many self-help books say, forgive, let it go, move on, don't hang on to anything from the past that might be, you know, a negative memory. And a lot of those self-help regimes seemed clearly incompatible with my enjoyable and I felt useful grudge-holding habit. So when I had this conversation with my sister, I thought, actually, I really believe that my grudges are not doing me any harm or making me feel bad, and they're actually fun and useful and protective and good for me in all kinds of ways. So then I said to my sister, oh, well, maybe I'll write a self-help book called How to Hold a Grudge. But probably there's so many books about grudges already that there's no point. And that's when I went to look it up and found that there was not a single book about grudges and barely any articles. I found like four short pieces in psychology journals about very specific manifestations of grudges. But nobody had ever undertaken a sort of thorough analysis of the phenomenon of grudges, either as a sort of scholarly academic project or as a sort of self-help popular psychology book.
Which is surprising, but, you know, it obviously spurred you into further action, and you did bring in some help here. Helen Acton and Anne Gray, how did they help you with the book, Sophie?
Well, the first thing I realized when I knew I was going to write a book about grudges is that, you know, some people might say, well, hold on a minute, she's a crime novelist, she's not a professional therapist, she's not got a psychology degree, where's the expertise here? So I asked two friends of mine, who are very much experts in their field. Helen is an existential psychotherapist with a practice in Cambridge, a private practice. She also is the counsellor in residence at Trinity College for Cambridge University. And Anne, for many, many years, has been a therapist, a healer, an emotional freedom therapy practitioner, a meditation teacher. And so I knew that they would both have expert and interesting takes on the subject of grudges. And I also suspected, which turned out to be true, that they would have sort of opposite takes. You know, they don't agree with each other entirely about grudges. So, for example, Helen thinks that forgiving somebody should not always be the aim and is not always the best thing to do. Anne, on the other hand, believes that forgiving is always a good thing to do for you and for the other person and for the world in general. So they both read the book as I was writing it, and I just asked them to offer comments whenever they wanted to. So anything that they read that they had something to say about, I said, just put it in the comments bit. And then I actually included a lot of their comments in the book itself, because I just thought readers will want to know what some professional experts think, not just what a crime novelist who happens to have lots of grudges thinks.
And the grudges are shared with us. The book is called How to Hold a Grudge: From Resentment to Contentment, The Power of Grudges to Transform Your Life. We'll get into the actions taken here, including the grudge cabinet and more, when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the British crime novelist Sophie Hannah, who has departed a bit from her usual genre by giving a self-help book. She likes to read self-help books and didn't find a single one that talked about a subject near and dear to her heart, which is holding grudges. So she wrote it. It's called How to Hold a Grudge: From Resentment to Contentment, The Power of Grudges to Transform Your Life. And it's a conversation you can join in the exchange. Share your grudges or what you've done with them in the past. 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. I mean, it's very lighthearted work. And it's really a pleasure to read, but it's not all jokey. I mean, there's obvious mental health benefits to not just stuffing your negative emotions and smiling through the pain, Sophie.
Exactly. And so this is part of the problem with the idea that we should forgive and we shouldn't hold grudges, because what happens when that mode of thinking is really dominant is that when something wrong is done to you, if somebody does something hurtful or completely out of order or something that naturally and justifiably makes you angry or upset, if you've got this very strong idea in your mind that you should forgive, that you should move on, then you will form a negative judgment about those natural and justifiable negative feelings. And what that does is it makes those feelings even, it adds a layer of negativity on top of the negativity. It makes people think, I shouldn't be angry. Am I an unforgiving person? Am I being unchristian? Is this not the right thing to do? What's wrong with me that I'm angry about this? And actually, that's completely damaging, really, because we are human beings. We're not perfect. We are going to get annoyed. We are going to get upset. Other people, capital O, capital P, often behave really badly. You know? I mean, we try to stop them by bossing them around, but they often still behave really badly. And it's absolutely fine and natural and understandable to get annoyed and upset when that happens. And so my method is advocating that when those totally understandable negative feelings arise, we welcome them and accept them. We say to them, hey, negative feelings, welcome, make yourselves at home. I completely get why you're here. You have every right to be here. Now, if you approach your negative feelings like that, then they won't feel defensive, and then they won't have to get stronger and insist on their right to be there. And actually what happens is your negative feelings pass much more quickly. So you allow yourself to be angry. You say, yeah, I'm going to be angry for as long as that feeling is there. Then the feeling passes more quickly. It's a really weird kind of paradox, but it's absolutely true.
Almost like house guests you didn't want to stay for too long, but you're okay with them for a little while.
Exactly. But, you know, with your negative feelings, I mean, obviously nobody wants to be oppressed by negative feelings or have their life ruined by them. But I think there's almost this delusion in some of the self-help that I've encountered, certainly, that we can somehow avoid or conquer our negative feelings, that we can get to a point where when somebody treats us badly, we can just think in the right way, think positive, and we don't need to be upset, we don't need to be angry. And I think in a way that point of view is quite harmful, because, you know, you'd have to be an absolute saint with no emotion whatsoever to be able to not respond with anger and hurt when someone does something really appalling to you. So it's far healthier to just think, yes, I'm angry, I'm upset, that's absolutely fine, and I'm not going to try not to be. And then if you think like that, and then you think about creating a constructive grudge, which is what my book is all about, it's all about how to hold a grudge in the right way, in a positive way. When you set about constructing your positive grudge and doing all the stages that I recommend in the book, you're actually putting all your energy into something positive and creative. And the effect that has is that your negative feelings, which are sort of sitting around being a bit neglected, really, because you're doing all this creative, positive work, your negative feelings then just dissolve quite naturally. Which is not to say that, you know, obviously if someone does something terrible to you, you might be angry for quite a long time. But there's no doubt that constructing a positive grudge and going through all those helpful stages will take a lot of the negative feeling and pain and power out of those negative grudges that you initially had. So I call it processing. You know, when we first get a grudge, it might feel absolutely packed full of negative feelings like bitterness, hostility, resentment, rage, hatred even. But those feelings are not the same as the grudge. And this is a big mistake that a lot of people make. People define a grudge as a negative and hostile feeling. Actually, the feelings are just what naturally arise as a result of the grudge-sparking incident, but they can pass. They are not the grudge itself. The grudge itself is not a feeling, it's a story. It's a story you remember about something negative that happened in the past, and you remember it because it can do you good in the present and the future. You can learn lessons from it. It can point you in the direction of the values that you most hold dear. It can do all kinds of good stuff. But in order to recognize that, we have to first separate out what a grudge really is from this completely mistaken idea that a grudge is a collection of bad feelings.
Sophie Hannah is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is How to Hold a Grudge, From Resentment to Contentment, The Power of Grudges to Transform Your Life. So not a feeling, a story. So you're giving more shape, more form to grudges in the book. And in fact, you advocate bringing them into physical space. The grudge cabinet is a really interesting development.
Yeah. So the reason I think it's important to actually write down your grudge story, I mean, you can type it up on your computer if you're a technological kind of modern person, but to get that story of what happened and how you felt and the conclusions you've drawn from it, to get that out of you and onto either a page in a notebook or a file on a computer so that it's literally out of you and into the world, then it becomes a real object. You feel less burdened immediately. I mean, I cannot tell you how much less burdened I felt when I wrote down my grudge stories, because that's doing something creative with them and getting them out of me and into an objective form. So that's really cathartic. And then also the object. So the object of the written story, which, you know, when I say a grudge cabinet, it can be a cabinet, it can be a handbag, it can be an old cardboard box. I mean, I say in the book that my grudge storage cabinet is actually the book. And I've also got a podcast called How to Hold a Grudge, which covers more material than I could fit in the book. And that's my other grudge cabinet. So I haven't actually got any, you know, actual little cupboard that I put my grudge stories in, because I don't need one, because I've put them all in the book. But it's the fact that they are objects. And if objects matter to you, then you want to store them in a safe place. So that was where the grudge cabinet came from. But I think the object nature of a grudge is really important, because if we accept that it's an object in the form of a story, then that can become what I call a symbolic justice object, which is another big, big benefit of holding a grudge. Human beings are justice-seeking creatures. From as young as 2 or 3, we hear children saying, "That's not fair. He got a bigger bit of cake than me." Children are very, very attuned to ideas of fairness. And as adults, we still care about justice. And the idea that someone has wronged us in an unfair way is really, really hard not to care about. So by writing down your grudge story and giving yourself official permission to hold that grudge and making it exist in the world as a real thing, we have a sort of commemorative justice object that makes us feel that the other person hasn't just got away with what they've done scot-free. It's not like it never happened and it didn't matter, because we have our symbolic justice object in the form of our grudge story to show that it does matter.
Something, it's a physical token, really. It's right there in the real world, outside the body, as you put it. Sophie Hanna is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is called How to Hold a Grudge, From Resentment to Contentment, The Power of Grudges to Transform Your Life. So we're talking about taking negative feelings and arranging them in a way that they become a positive thing for you. Join us on the Exchange if you have questions or comments or stories to share about grudges you have held as well. 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. And Sophie, I do want to give an example, because you provide some excellent ones in the book, and there's a whole lot we haven't gotten to yet. But the Michael upside down in the doorway story, in which your friend Michael scared you awake when staying at his house. He turned on the light and bent over in the doorway to look for his dog under your bed. He's a bit obsessive about the dog, even he admits. Now, in the aftermath, you point out you're still friends. You have stayed at the house again. So how did holding a grudge against Michael, or does it still help you?
Well, so I'm very keen to stress in the book, and whenever I talk about this, that holding a grudge about somebody does not mean that you have to stop seeing them or that you have to dislike them and cut them out of your life. You can hold a grudge about somebody and still like them, and even you can still love them. You can still see them really regularly. So, I mean, you don't have to. Holding a grudge about someone can also be compatible with deciding that you don't want them in your life anymore, but that's a separate decision. All that holding a grudge means, as far as I see it, is there's something that happened, something that person did that was not okay and that you have deemed grudge-worthy, and you want to remember this because you feel it's important to do so. Now, why you feel it's important, usually there's some element of protection. So with the Michael grudge, and I say in the book, you know, there's one story, Michael upside down in the doorway, which is told in full. But then after that happened, I realized that there were other Michael stories on a similar theme. And basically, I realized that whenever I stay overnight at his house, he finds a way to wreck my sleep so that I don't have a good night's sleep. And I don't know whether it's an attention-seeking urge in him or whether he just lives in a way that happens to be incompatible with guests getting a good night's sleep. But I want to remember that grudge, because it will mean, and it has meant, that whenever I can, I stay somewhere else, not at Michael's house. And it's as simple as that. I don't think he's a bad person. I don't dislike him. I do think he's got a weird inability to realize that if you put someone up for the night, you should ideally allow them to sleep during the night as well.
True.
But it's as simple as that. It's not a sort of bitter and hate-filled grudge. It's just, I need to remember that Michael did this and that he has a tendency to behave like that. And if I remember that about Michael, then my decisions and behavior around him in future will not be blind and naive and assuming that, he'll behave the same as everyone else I know, but they'll be properly informed based on past experience.
So this is a way in which a grudge can be a very positive thing, that you're essentially indicating what your own boundaries are and the points beyond which you are not willing to go.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, I am very, very much in favor of forgiveness emotionally. So, you know, I think forgiveness to me means emotionally not having any anger, dislike, resentment, or any residue of bad feelings towards someone. And that's absolutely fine. But the grudge part of it is that you can think, you can feel entirely benevolently towards somebody, but you can still, on a sort of judgment level, know that that person does not have a completely clean slate where you are concerned. So, I mean, because people have said to me since the book came out, people have said, well, hang on a minute, why are you calling this a grudge? Why are you not simply calling it a lesson learned from something that happened in the past? That's not a grudge. That's just, you know, being sensible and remembering what happened and acting accordingly. If you can forgive people emotionally, then you haven't got a grudge about them. And I strongly disagree with that, because the grudge element is linked to the that person not having a clean slate factor. So, you know, there is a level on which I guess I don't trust Michael with my well-being in the same way that I trust friends of mine who do have a completely clean slate. So to me, that's why the grudge definition feels relevant and appropriate.
So it truly is a cautionary tale then. I mean, you've got some lines of caution permanently drawn around Michael and staying at his place.
Yeah, and then with other people, I mean, I think probably we all do this naturally, that if somebody behaves badly to us in a certain way, if we're sensible, we think, right, that person has a tendency to behave like that. I might still want to keep them in my life and have a great time with them and enjoy all their good qualities, but I do need to remember that they do that suboptimal thing, and that's not okay with me, and I'm going to have a grudge about it. It's really a way of, I mean, the problem with the traditional definition of grudge is that, you know, someone does something wrong and then we're consumed by negative feelings and hatred that never goes away. What that does, as well as being inaccurate, because it's certainly not true of my grudges, but the other sort of unfortunate thing it does is that it conflates feelings with thoughts and intellectual conclusions. And so my grudges are intellectual conclusions that I've drawn about who is and isn't safe to trust with various particular things. But those grudges don't preclude me from emotionally moving on and forgiving the person and feeling, you know, wanting the best for them and wishing them well, which of course allows for the possibility that they will change that behavior. You know, if I happened to need to stay with Michael for one or two nights and he was absolutely considerate and made sure not to wake me up, then I would not any longer need that grudge about him.
But for
as long as he behaves as though it doesn't matter whether I get any sleep or not, then I do still need to bear that grudge in mind.
Right, you hold on to that grudge. Sure, that makes sense. There's a quiz in here, Sophie, which allows readers to find themselves in one of four categories: cutoff queen, empathetic analyst, easy lifer, or grudge guru. You identify yourself as a grudge guru. Is there any downside to being a grudge guru?
I think, yes. So in each of the types in the book, I say what the upsides and downsides are. I think the downside to being a grudge guru is that, you know, if you develop a podcast on the subject of grudges, and if you're writing books and articles about grudges, I suppose there's a danger that you can get too enthusiastic about collecting new grudges, and you could create ones where they don't need to exist. So, you know, in my enthusiasm for finding new types and classifications of grudge, I have to make sure I don't just find, you know, things which are in fact not grudge-worthy at all and mistakenly label them as grudge-worthy just because I want to find a new grudge type.
There's a key part here about grudges and forgiveness, and we did talk about forgiveness earlier, and your two experts, Helen Acton and Anne Gray, disagree on even this point. So I mean, is forgiveness part of getting rid of a grudge?
I think they're two separate things. Mm-hmm. So it depends whether you're using the traditional definition of the word grudge or whether you're using my new and improved definition. In the traditional definition, holding a grudge is the opposite of forgiving someone. So in order to forgive, you'd have to let your grudge go. According to my definition, you can either forgive someone or not, but if you do choose to forgive them, that doesn't mean that you can't still have your grudge. And again, it's that difference between emotionally being open to them and loving them or liking them, giving them another chance, having fun with them and not feeling any kind of hard, unpleasant things about them. But at the same time, remembering that they did something that was not okay and you want to remember that because you feel in some way you can still learn from it or be inspired by it. So, for example, I have a very, very close friend who is a really brilliant person. She's good. She's kind. She's a thoroughly good person.
So if you're going to have to stop and pause you there, we'll have to come back and get the story about this good person in just a moment. We're on our way to a break.
Okay.
Sophie Hanna with us to talk about how to hold a grudge. We'll let her finish her story on the other side of a break and take phone calls and emails from you on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the internationally known crime thriller writer Sophie Hanna. She has published works in 49 different languages, including three works with Agatha Christie's old character, Hercule Poirot. She also writes poetry, but she's not writing either poetry or crime fiction this time. She's writing a self-help book called How to Hold a Grudge, From Resentment to Contentment, The Power of Grudges to Transform Your Life. What do you think? Has a grudge really helped you define the way you feel about someone and the way they've treated you and have a better relationship perhaps because of it? Join us on the Exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Sophie, you were starting to tell a story about a friend of yours, a really good friend, apparently.
Yeah, so she's lovely. She's a great person. She's really, really a positive thing, and I adore her. But she has one particular behavior that I feel is grudge-worthy, and that is that she never, ever asks me any questions. So she never says, how are you? What have you been up to? She never, like, for all she knows, I could have given up writing 3 years ago and become a plumber or an electrician, and she wouldn't know. She chats very enthusiastically about loads of topics, but she just never shows an interest in me or my life or asks me any questions. So I don't think that's okay. I think if you're a close friend of somebody, you should show an interest in them, and I regularly ask her questions and take a keen interest in her life. And she doesn't seem to notice that it's all a one-way street. So I do think that behavior is grudge-worthy, and I do have a grudge about that, but I don't allow that grudge to make me resent her or be angry or to end our friendship. So I can still, and I do regularly still see her, and we have a great time together, but that grudge does protect me because, A, it reinforces an important value of mine, namely that if you care about somebody, you should be interested, ask them questions, make them feel that you want to know what's going on with them. And B, it makes me able to protect myself because if something fascinating is going on in my life, I choose not to share it with that particular friend because I know she just won't listen and will change the subject because she just doesn't seem to be particularly interested. It's not just in me. She's like this with everybody. She just doesn't ask questions. So that is a way in which the grudge protects and inspires me, but still allows me to like her and love her and enjoy everything that's good about her.
So it sounds like the recipient of the grudge generally does not know that the grudge exists.
Well, that is totally up to each individual person. So there are some people who I believe do talk about their grudges. I tend not to. You know, I tend not to say to people, hey, do you know I have a grudge about you for this reason? Because I don't want to try and control anyone else's behavior. So I am absolutely fine with people behaving exactly as they want. You know, if I said to my friend who doesn't ask questions, you know, hey, how come you never show an interest in me? I think that's a bit weird and not ideal. I'm absolutely sure she would then say, oh, how terrible of me, and then start asking me 15 questions every time I saw her. And I don't want to control or manipulate people's behavior in that way. And I don't, this is another crucial thing, I don't need anybody to behave in a certain way in order for me to be okay. I cannot take their behavior personally. I can think, okay, I don't think that's good. And maybe it has made me angry. Maybe it has upset me. But if I construct my grudge story and hold my grudge in an inspiring and motivating way, then that person's behavior really barely affects me in a negative way. So, you know, I got together with my not interested in me friend recently. We had a brilliant time. She didn't ask me any questions and I didn't mind. I just have my there telling me that I don't think that behavior is ideal. So, you know, for me, it's a system that works really well.
But and there's no value in saying, well, let me tell you what I'm doing. Or maybe you do that already.
Well, I have tried to do that, mm-hmm. but, you know, she listens to the first four or five words and then she'll say something like, yeah, yeah, it's okay, I've got the gist. And then she'll change the subject.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah, no, she's, but it's just really weird because she, you know, it's nothing personal. It's just what she's like. She does it to everyone. And in loads of other ways, she's kind and thoughtful and she really cares about people and she's loyal. So, you know, I think also another real benefit of grudge holding is that it allows you, if you do it in the way I'm suggesting in the book, it allows you to separate the person from the action. So part of the reason people are scared of admitting that holding grudges is natural and good and unavoidable is because I think we fear that then maybe that means people will be condemned forever, you know, never let off the hook. But actually, the grudge is always about the action that someone did, the behavior. It's not about writing off the person as a whole, complete entity. And my system of grudges really recognizes that because you continue the relationship with the person who is, as we all are, a mixture of good and bad behavior, and you have a grudge about the particular behavior. So it, you know, in Christian terms, it separates the sinner from the sin.
Mm-hmm. And as you point out, the grudge should not be vengeful, all-consuming, and bitter. And I'm sure there are a lot of people thinking, well, darn it, you're taking the fun out. But we are talking to Sophie Hanna about her book, How to Hold a Grudge. Here's a call from Mike in Yreka, California. Welcome to The Exchange.
Yes, thank you. As a past teacher myself, I have seen the benefits of those schools that teach conflict management. And we are so concerned about the amount of shootings that happen in our schools. We have people walking around that have not been in contact with those who have hurt them. And when we have schools that teach conflict management, we teach students how to deal with the grudges that they have and to recognize and deal with them instead of shooting and killing people. And I don't think she recognizes that and sees the benefits of actually going to the person along with structured help and trying to find a peaceful way of reconciling yourself instead of leading to violence.
All right. All right. Thanks for the point, Mike. I want to bring that up with Sophie now. So, Sophie, I mean, is there some value? I mean, there are some people you have to work with that you want to get past a bad spot with. I mean, how do you deal with those sorts of situations?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't disagree with anything the caller. So, absolutely, one of the things I really stress is that a grudge should never be allowed to harm. If it's causing you harm by filling you with unpleasant feelings, if it's going to cause other people harm by, you know, you getting a gun and going and shooting someone, then that is a toxic grudge, which needs to be either processed so that it becomes non-toxic or it needs to be abandoned. And in terms of going and talking to the person and trying to achieve a peaceful resolution to a problem, there's nothing at all that I'm saying that's against that. If somebody wants to do that and feels that that would work and would lead to a peaceful resolution, and after that peaceful resolution, they would then not need to have their grudge, then that is absolutely a brilliant thing to do. All I'm saying is that it often in situations, whether you do or don't want to discuss it with the person who you've got the grudge about, holding a grudge in a positive way, in a way that does no harm to anybody, is another way of achieving a resolution for yourself and achieving a sort of inner peaceful state.
I have not even gotten into the varieties of grudges you list here, which end up in about 30 different grudge types. A couple that really jumped out of the list at me. One is the people of the lie grudges. What is that?
So people of the lie grudge is one of the weirdest grudges. It's one of the absolute weirdest grudges because most of them are very straightforward, you know, rudeness grudge or disloyalty grudge. Everyone can imagine what they are. There is a book called People of the Lie by a writer called M. Scott Peck. And he says that in his practice as a, I think either a psychotherapist or a psychiatrist, the only people he's ever met who he thinks are truly evil are not the people who've necessarily done evil acts. It's the people who might have done almost less evil acts, but who are incapable of realizing that they might do harm. So he says the most evil people he's ever met are people who are just so sure that they're on the side of rightness and goodness that nothing they do can possibly be wrong. And therefore what happens is when they do things wrong, which we all do, they have to define it so that the people they're doing the harm to deserve it because they are pure and good and would never do any harm. And I really recognized when I read that book by M. Scott Peck, I really recognized that description because in my life as well, the people who I've felt are most dangerous are not the ones who do a bad thing in the full knowledge it's a bad thing and that they've done something wrong. The most scary people I've encountered are the ones who say, but I'm lovely and so I can't possibly have done a bad thing. And so the person I did a bad thing to must be awful and must have deserved it. And it's because of the intellectual dishonesty that, you know, well, that's why they're called people of the lie. So a people of the lie grudge is a grudge about somebody who falls into that category and employs that behavior.
And I mentioned this ends up in a list of roughly 30 grudge types. Does the list keep growing? It seems like the people who respond to your website are adding to the list over time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm getting so many emails and tweets and I mean, people are commenting all over the place. And yeah, I'm regularly accumulating new grudge types. Someone sent one in the other day, which was she called it a mangling grudge, which is where a book you really love is adapted for TV and whoever adapted it for the screen mangles it in a way that changes it from the original. I thought that's a great classification, a book mangling grudge. That's a grudge you'd only hold against a screenwriter specifically.
Right. There's a lot of great examples. One in particular resonated with me, which was the unreasonable imposition grudge, which makes me wonder aloud, and I don't know if you even know the answer, why do people ask things of people because they won't ask them of other people? You know, in other words, when the way I read the unreasonable imposition grudge is when somebody says, well, I'm asking you to do this. It's like, why are you asking me? Well, I can't ask them.
Interesting. I mean, I think so. There's probably two subcategories of the unreasonable imposition grudge. There's probably people who unreasonably impose on almost anyone they can because they are just unreasonable imposers. And then there are possibly more devious and strategic unreasonable imposers who choose the people they know will be least likely to resist. But either way, it's an unreasonable imposition grudge. I mean, the fascinating question for me is, why do so many people not realize when they're unreasonably imposing? I mean, some of the things that have been, well, some of the attempts at unreasonable imposition on me, I've been absolutely staggered. Like, isn't it hilarious that person doesn't realize that they're asking way too much? How can they not realize that?
There's a whole chapter in How to Hold a Grudge on people who do not hold grudges. And in your mind, are they okay, Sophie?
Absolutely. I'm very careful to say that, you know, if grudges arise in us naturally and we try to repress them, that's not healthy because we all have negative feelings, naturally arising negative feelings, and some of us want to remember the stories that led to us having those feelings. Some of us don't. But the only bad thing is if we are a natural grudge holder trying not to be one. If, on the other hand, you're somebody like my husband who, you know, something will happen, he'll be annoyed about it. 10 minutes later, he'll have totally forgotten about it. And if I didn't remind him occasionally, he'd go, you know, he would just sort of, it would be as if that thing hadn't happened. So somebody who doesn't naturally accumulate any desire to hold a grudge, then those people are fine as they are. Although I would argue that they're maybe not as protected as they should be. And that's certainly true of my husband. Many, many times we've had a conversation where he will say something like, Bob invited me out for a drink. Shall I go for a drink with Bob, do you think? And I'll say, well, I don't know. Remember, the last three times you went out for a drink with Bob, he stole your wallet and fled to Venezuela. and my husband will go, oh, yeah. Oh, I'd forgotten that. Oh, yeah, well, maybe I won't take my wallet with me. And, you know, I do think if you never remember and make a note of all the ways in which people might have treated you badly, then you are going to go through life somewhat naive and ill-equipped, I would argue.
Well, it really is about protecting yourself and making sure that you keep track of the people who have done things that you don't want them to do again. The book is called How to Hold a Grudge, From Resentment to Contentment, The Power of Grudges to Transform Your Life. It is the work of Sophie Hanna, who is best known for writing a lot of crime fiction and some poetry. Sophie, thanks so much for writing the book and for joining us on The Exchange today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on the show.